Thank you for that excellent introduction. And at the very last minute, putting it together was great. And thank you for the blessing. It's felt. It works. It's already set a tone of reception. We're already in a feedback loop together. Well, I have to tell you that when Bob gave me the assignment of chapter 4 in a book I had never read, I didn't realize that he was going to hit a sweet spot in my own life and a memory of when my life intersected with the work that is the core of Judy Cannato's book. It was in 1979 when I read the article that summarized the work of Thomas Berry. Let me see if I'm getting this right, Tom. Yes. It appeared in a journal under the heading of The New Story. It was a little article that I was so riveted by that I Xeroxed it. I put it in my working files, and I've kept it all these years. I take it out and read it from time to time because it is hands down the best summary of an enormous amount of change and development culturally, scientifically, that has happened in the last 200 years. Well, what's interesting about this story is that Tom Berry stands in the footsteps of Teilhard de Chardin. He was a monk, a cultural historian, a genius visionary who called himself a geologian rather than a theologian. 3 years after I read his article, another book was published that took Tom Berry's work far, much further afield. It was called The New Science of Life by Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, and it turned the British science establishment on its ear. 4 years before that, Denis Gabor received a Nobel Prize for his work in holonomy. The maths and the holograms that he created were enormously intriguing. But what we didn't know at the time was that his work and its implications about the way things are actually related and interrelated would turn our ideas of relationship upside down and take them to a new dimension. In the midst of all of this, Berry wrote a book with Brian Swim that immediately caught fire and became the philosophical underpinnings that set the context for all of these new scientific breakthroughs. There's Berry communing with a tree. And a few years after that, about 5 years after that, in the Santa Cruz Mountains, the Heart Math Institute set up shop and began to develop a body of research that has given legs for the new story to walk out on right into the church aisles. Those are the players that we're going to examine and walk along with this morning in Judy Cannato's book, Fields of Compassion. She sets Tom Berry's new story, the story of the universe is called in her book, but I call it the new story, beside Christian tradition, which I am calling the old story. And in chapter 4, she asks us to begin to look at what happens when we find those two stories converging at points and the overlap that emerges in our own understanding. Both of these stories are master stories about God. What is God? Empedocles wrote in 400 BC that the nature of God is a circle, whose center is everywhere and circumference nowhere. But of course, we're talking about two versions of God now. And I found an old form from sacred geometry that seems to do the job for us. The old story overlaps with the new story. And in that overlap, that the Psyche of Pisces is a ground of being that's just not flat ideas, but filled with living information that will take our understanding of this convergence to a new place this morning. This has become a Christian symbol, this center place, this place of overlap. Here it carries the risen Jesus. It appears on almost every medieval church across Europe. But for our purposes, this is what it's going to look like. In the middle, with the risen Christ, with the new story that is coming into us, is a kind of understanding that is new, emergent, transcending all that we've known before, including it to take along on the journey a little further. These two circles represent dual realities. The new story brings sets of concepts that point to an increasingly non-dual reality. And that is a view that has been held by a tiny population of Christians over the decades. The mystics are now holding hands with Tom Berry and Rupert Sheldrake. Shortly after I read the book by Tom Berry, I decided that I would take in a workshop about resonance given by an English woman named Jill Purse. She was going to talk about overtone chanting, something that I was newly interested in. The workshop was held at the Upham Hotel. And I toddled down there one Saturday morning and found her to be an extraordinary woman, filled with knowledge, skills, and a great depth of understanding. I was a little late from the coffee break, having taken a phone call that I should not have taken. And as I was hustling down the corridor to the conference room, I kept hearing the bellboy call from the front desk, and I thought, how is this possible that we can hear these bellboys' bells? And as I walked into the room, I realized that it was Jill Purse's voice. Those were the overtones that were coming with her deep chanting. I sat down, mesmerized. How many of you have heard overtone chanting? Only a few. It's really comes to us from the East, but it's now beginning to be experimented with here. An overtone chant is this. One holds a deep, strong, resonant tone, sustained tone on a big breath, and you just hum it out as strongly and loudly for a very sustained time. It is a sustained, coherent note that vibrates, and as it vibrates, it will eventually raise into the native harmonics that are embedded in that tone. So one could say that just a sung tone is only half alive. A chanted tone is fully alive. It may not necessarily end up as overtone notes, but it ends up resonating and entraining a great deal more of us than we actually understand. Jill told us a lot of interesting stories that morning, but one I'd like to share with you. It's from Alfred Tomatis, a French physician and ear specialist, who was called maybe 5 years after Vatican II was announced, to a Benedictine monastery in France, where all the monks were ailing. Their new abbot had decided, a la the Vatican announcement, that it was time to do away with the old, and the monks dutifully did away with the old and began to get sick. Tomatis diagnosed that they needed to return to their old schedule, which had appalled the abbot. 5 to 6 hours of sleep at night, 6 to 8 hours of chanting, and then they fit the rest of the monastic life around it. Tomatis put them back to chanting. He gave them a special diet of extra sounds that they should be paying attention to, and within weeks, their vigor had returned, and they were healthy and well again. Something goes on with chanting that is partakes of wholeness. Well, Don Campbell, an expert in sound, health, and spirituality here in California, tells us that if we chant any good, simple chant for 9 to 12 minutes, it will literally change our own biochemistry and our state of consciousness. Chanting, it turns out, is a powerful form of resonance. I think it brings us literally closer to the field of God's presence. This is what Jill looks like today. She's still singing and still doing wonderful work. What I didn't know in those days was that, the monks. Sorry, my finger has lagged my story. What I didn't know at the time was that Jill was the wife, still is, of Rupert Sheldrake, the author of The Science of Life, whom I just happened to be invited to meet over a little supper in Santa Barbara about maybe 5 years after I read the Tom Berry article. He was a charming conversationalist, a very modest and extremely intelligent man. And I learned from him that his wife and he really are at work in the same field. That resonance is simply a form of vibrational reality, of which there are many versions. Rupert is famous for the kind of resonant field that gathers when some new phenomenon happens, when a new pattern of organization has come into being. Its morphological field stabilizes that change when the circumstances are repeated physically again and again. The field becomes stronger, and the same pattern is more likely to happen again. Fields contain a kind of cumulative memory and become increasingly habitual. Fields evolve in time and form habits of nature that we've assumed were actually laws. Rupert says, most of nature is inherently chaotic. It's not rigidly determined in the old sense. It's not rigidly predictable. When his book was critiqued by the establishment in England, the Science Nature Journal famously headlined, "This is a book for burning." He has had a somewhat uphill climb with scientific orthodoxy ever since. However, in other disciplines where rigorous thinking and work goes on, this theory has been welcomed. It's especially interesting, for instance, in psychology. Think of Jung's collective unconscious. Think of archetypal patterning. Well, consider the fashions and the fads that whisk through our culture today. Think about the incredible change in social mores that simply erupted, unheralded in the 60s, and is hurtling on today. All of these are field effects. Sheldrake is part of the gradual shift from a mechanistic cause and effect paradigm to an evolutionary holistic worldview, where everything is evolving collectively, where new variations arise by means of patterning systems that are fields of possibility, that stabilize with steadiness and repetition. Richard Rohr puts it this way, God creates things that continue to create themselves. The geometric design that we are using with its overlap appears throughout nature as well. I particularly like this galactic one with all of the promise that it holds. We're comfortable now with some of these concepts about resonance and morphogenetic fields, so let's look at some of these points of convergence that Kanato has in Chapter 4. She talks about the two master stories of creation. The old story has God hovering over the void and creating seas and land, animals, humans, in 6 days. The new story says that it began with one enormous bang, everything unfolding out of the bang and evolving together and collectively ever since. The discoveries in those years around Berry's essay make inroads into this mystery. Now, we're remembering about 7 years earlier than Sheldrake's book that Gabor received his Hologram Laureate Award. We first saw that hologram, probably at least I did, with my kids at Star Wars. Here is Princess Leia trembling in front of Obi-Wan Kenobi, imploring his help. Well, Princess Leia, in that fictional world, will have stood making her pitch in front of a futuristic camera equipped with a coherent laser light. Gabor developed the mathematics. His physicist friends created the laser light. Ordinary light fluctuates like a bat going across an evening sky. Laser light is a completely coherent beam. When that coherent beam shines on an object and hits mirrors that reflect that light all around the object, it will produce on a photographic negative a unique pattern of light and dark, so that when the negative is held up and a laser light is projected through it, the entire three-dimensional form appears. Now, what's interesting about that whole dimensional form is this, that the sum of the whole turns out to be much greater than its parts. The sum of the whole is, in fact, embedded in every one of its parts. If we take that negative and break it in half and then show the laser beam through it, we will have two Princess Leias quivering for Obi-Wan Kenobi. If we break it into fourths, we'll have four of them. If we break it into sixteenths, we'll have 16 much smaller Princess Leias. We can break that negative all the way down to its smallest part. Leia's still there. But the resolution isn't as good. The whole is contained in every part. This is the way the universe is actually made. Here's another example. As we come into being in our mother's womb, we emerge through every stage of life that planet Earth has so far developed. We are first fish. We actually have gills. We shortly become reptiles and fold out into the tiny arms and legs of early mammals. We even have tails which eventually are subsumed by our spinal cord. At the end, we come out a full-fledged human being, carrying with us not just an ancestral idea, but literally within our tissues, the entire history of our planet works. And it is accessible when we use our intelligence in new ways. The psalmist wrote all those years ago, "What is man that thou art mindful of him? He's little lower than the angels." Well, we know now that not only are we a hologram of the planet, but research tells us that our brains that take part of the entire body's intelligence, are holograms of the universe itself. Underpinning all of this is the shimmering, creation-bent field of consciousness. Consciousness is the ultimate whole of which we are all a part, and which infuses all its parts. The wholeness is infused with intelligence as well. Mystics have already known this. Pythagoras, a Greek, a mystic, wrote 1,500 years ago, "Astonishing! Everything is intelligent." Plants can communicate with us. Even metals respond to stimuli. We're going to end with the last of the beginnings, the Logos, the Word. These words all describe the characteristics of this unfolding holonomic universe that's now increasingly beginning to be called the Holoverse. At the top is the word holo. It is the root and meaning, literally and semantically, of the words that follow. Just let this resonate in your mind as I read them aloud. Whole, holy, healthy, healing, wholeness. These are the characteristics of the Holoverse. They're not only, positive and upbeat, isn't that nice, but they are enormous in their implications of the way the universe really works, the way it is meant to thrive, the way it is meant to be collectively intelligent and alive. Now, Canato and Karl Rahner address the convergence of the old and the new at great length in Chapter 4 when they talk about salvation. The old story has wrestled for well over 2,000 years with the inheritance of Judaism's original sin and the codes of law that evolved to deal with sin and forgiveness. Jesus embraced it all by summing it up in just two great commandments. Love the Lord thy God with everything in you, and love your neighbor as yourself. He summed up thousands of years of evolution and development and transcended it, but included it, which of course is one of the principles of the new universe story, as Kanato tells us. The two commandments have fared well and poorly in the 2,000 years since. Our institutionalized Christianity has moved and evolved through a variety of ways of understanding salvation, but we've all pretty much come out, at least at this point, with Karl Rahner, who sees salvation as communal, that we are responsible to and for one another, that the question of today becomes, what's the life-giving choice in this moment? The new story builds on that consensus, and it places the agency of salvation where Jesus placed it, in the place where we know and we think. So we move again into the convergent zone of the overlapping two stories, the old and the new, where everything operates on the basis of consciousness. Max Planck famously wrote, remember, he was the man who made a career of discovering what the structure of the atom was. He's one of the great figures in the new story. Well, having worked with matter all his life, he ended up by saying there is no matter as such. All matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force which brings the particle of an atom to vibration and holds this most minute solar system of the atom together. We must assume behind this force the existence of conscious and intelligent mind. Now, if we look again at this overlap, we're going to take another lens, put another lens in the middle, and we'll find that it's the heart. When we look through the lens of neurocardiology, we see the heart that Jesus implores us to use as a field of energy that shifts into a higher mode of intelligence when we ourselves have become more conscious. The heart is the body's master pump and its master oscillator. It's the drumbeat that sets the rhythm of all our cells. It's also the power source of all the electromagnetic fields that are constantly emanating from our body to a particular magnetic resonant imaging machine. This is what you look like. These are fields that carry the information from every part of the body to register in the heart's neural field. It's something like a morphogenetic field. Now, there are billions of brain neurons in the heart that also link to the brain and the head, but we have been acculturated to operate them separately. The heart does its own thing. The mind, the intellect, does its own thing. The left side of this chart, provided by the Institute of Natural of Health, the HeartMath Institute, shows us what happens on the left side of the chart in our normal mode of operation. Our respiration, our heart rate variability, our blood pressure have these readouts. This is our natural signature. However, when we deliberately move into another state of consciousness that puts us into the feeling place of the heart immediately does what it was designed to do. It trumps the brain. It entrains it and brings it into the kind of coherence that happens in a laser light. This coherence does something interesting. You can see it literally evening out all these functions in the body so that they are all not only working evenly, they are all working at the same amplitude. This is a state called coherence. This is the Jesus state. This is the state that walks on water and produces miracles. You can get a feel for what the state is like when we flip back to coherent light for a moment. William Tiller, emeritus professor at Stanford, writes this. His career has been with coherent light, with laser light. The shift from incoherence to coherence can bring dramatic effects. A 60-watt light bulb whose light waves could be made coherent as a laser, would have the power to bore a hole through the sun from 90 million miles away. When the head and heart work together, another function, another quality of intelligence and consciousness emerge. We move into a state of heart and head wholeness that gives us a much wider bandwidth of awareness and intelligence. We will call this from here on in the heart state of consciousness. In that state, our parasympathetic system takes over, and we're removed from the fight or flight anxieties of standard brain functioning. We've moved into the Jesus state. We're no longer afraid. We are trusting, and so trusting and aware of everything around us that we can sense, not figure out, not calculate, but just know instantly where everyone's coming from and what's really going on. When we're unafraid and trusting, that bandwidth allows us to sense much more information. Plus, we broadcast coherence in our fields, which affect everyone around us. HeartMath research has found that coherent heart fields register in our neighbors' fields and modulate them measurably. The HeartMath Institute has launched a global coherence program. It's estimated to take about 15 years to put into action. Its goal is very close to the TM meditation experiment that we heard about last week, when a critical mass of meditators moved into a state of coherence with their meditation. And in Washington, D.C., the crime rate dropped. They didn't stay together in that particular configuration, not long enough to have started a morphogenetic field, say, that might have kept feeding into that kind of work. But the HeartMath people do know what it takes. So stay tuned. Look them up online. You'll find it very interesting. But above all, I'd like us to think of this coherent state as an agent of salvation. We rescue and help, ease and open the way for each other when we are in a coherent heart state of consciousness. And we enable ourselves with an intelligence that operates through wholeness. It always leaves an effect. Remember Bell's theorem, when two protons collide, then they leave never to see each other again, and one turns right, the other turns right? Well, the coherent heart state leaves a bit of blessing always in another's field. Now, I'd like to add one little word here about the scale of caring that's involved with this business of a coherent heart state. We talk a lot about love as Christians. We talk a lot about love everywhere. Love is either a hallmark sentimentality or something grand and operatic. We hardly know really how to handle the word love. I would suggest that coherence would use the word affection. It's a wonderful mode of loving. Think about affection in your own body. Just think about your pets. That's affection. Affection is a felt sense. It's tolerant, humorous, appreciative, and honest. And it's a big bandwidth of consciousness that can leaven everything around you and will draw in information that easily answers Rahner's salvation question, what's the life-giving choice here? But that's really only half the story of salvation. In a state of heart coherence, we begin picking up information that is vibrating from all the life forms around us. Suddenly, the outdoors, the world we live in, ceases to become scenic wallpaper in our lives, and it becomes filled with living entities that are truly not just alive, but are actually sibling species at work with us here in the planet Earth. It's a St. Francis universe where a kind of personhood exists in all living things. Now, this wholeness of caring stretches us to a new understanding of how intimately we are related to the living earth. Here is a picture of the design that happens on the front of the book. On the left, you will see the Lena Delta in eastern Siberia. That's what's on your book. It's a NASA picture. On the right, you'll see something that looks remarkably like it, though much smaller, and it's inside our chests. It's our lungs. You will note that they operate with the same structure. They do, in fact, follow the same function, though on a different scale. Each sustains life with a flow of oxygen or water. This is an example of the kind of relationships that vibrate together in the universe. They match up and carry wholeness at deep levels that put us all, literally all, on the same patterns of wholeness. Now, I'd like to look at the final implication of the last words of the second commandment while we're still talking about salvation. Love your neighbor as yourself. We are also a whole, filled with parts, all of whom, not which. They're all whoms. They're all living systems. They are all little tiny kingdoms, little solar systems of intelligence. Our body is a holoverse in its own right. Remember our fetal hologram. We're a system of wholeness teeming with self-organizing organs and tissues, all cooperating with each other, all busy repairing, replacing, and recreating their own systems. The lining of our intestines replaces itself every 6 days. They're busy. Our outer skin layers get replaced every 4 to 6 weeks. Our skeleton is totally replaced every 10 years. Lynn Margulis, who is a brilliant biologist, square in the middle of the new story, writes this: life on Earth is more like a verb. It repairs. Life recreates. Life regularly outdoes itself. The postulate of the new story in Rupert Sheldrake is that the blueprints for the ongoing repair and occasional recreation of our body systems is carried in the blueprint memory of morphogenetic fields, which, remember, are partaking of the constant energies and presence of the forming consciousness of the universe, whose imperative is both to conserve and make new its creations. The ultimate building block of the living organisms that we all are is the operation of the vast population that has been the basis of all life on Earth. Again, Margulis. Life on Earth is such a good story, you can't afford to miss the beginning. Beneath our superficial differences, we are, all of us, walking communities of bacteria. The world shimmers, a pointless landscape made of tiny, living things. I love that the hordes of tiny bacteria are also children of God in their own right. That whole growing, repairing, recreating, cooperating circus of our existence is infused with the informing presence of God, so that we include incarnation but make the circle wider to information. The heart is the carrier wave, simultaneously weaving in the guiding signals of presence to which it is innately attuned. The mystics in the old story knew this. Brother Lawrence practiced the presence of God most fully in his kitchen and garden. Theophane the recluse urged, "Let your mind descend into your heart and talk with God there. It is the reception room of the Lord." Well, the new story meets the old to shift the visit with God from a room to a state of consciousness. It's quite a leap, a quantum leap for us who are still largely operating with old story notions. But such leaps are the very stuff of evolution. The dry terms of an evolutionist call it punctuated equilibrium. Jesus of Nazareth was a quantum leap that downloaded its new potential for non-dual consciousness as the hidden gift of Pentecost. It's taken us 2,000 years for it to finally surface in the general population after being kept alive by the monastics and mystics of the past. The shift to this state of awakened consciousness is a little like the first amphibians moving from their watery state to their land-based state. C.S. Lewis writes, "Humans are amphibians, half spirit, half animal. As spirits, they belong to the eternal world. As animals, they inhabit time." Now, these words, seen through that middle lens of the overlap, no longer just resonate as poetry or a pleasant old idea. They actually are talking about what we are doing. We are, in fact, amphibians. We are moving to another state of consciousness that is so much bigger than what we ordinarily operate with that we can only begin just to glimpse what lies ahead if we don't blow ourselves up first, being stuck in the old consciousness. But it takes work to make the amphibian change. Making the shift is what I would call field work in all its iterations. The sheer labor and effort of learning to meditate, the constant nagging difficulty of forcing ourselves to go beyond our super-muscled intellect to operate in the larger arena of whole-body intelligence, the time, discipline, some money, but mainly effort that it takes to develop a coherent heart state that brings us into connection with the fields of everyone else's heart, everyone else's information. And it's hard work taking seriously that these invisible fields of memory, feeling, and presence are as valid as the chairs we are sitting on. The new story is composed of huge and sweeping concepts that we will now step down into a package to take home. All this buzzing, blooming universe and its fields of energy and consciousness is simply your own backyard. It's your own landscape that is in intimate relationship with the wholeness of creation swimming along beside you and inside you. No one understands this better than another man named Barry. We opened with Thomas Barry, the great visionary, the geologian, standing in the footprints of Teilhard de Chardin and writing down for the first time this sweep of implication that comes from all of the hard work that the human species has been doing for the last 2,000 years. Another man named Barry, a little younger than Thomas, this guy's still alive, is very famous for his own visionary genius. He's a farmer. He's a poet. He's also a modern-day Thoreau, who has become fairly famous. Here he is last year receiving the National Endowment for the Humanities Award for his life work, and the medal is being given by our president. He was chosen to give the Jefferson Lecture, which is the highest honor for intellectual achievement on a subject in the receiver's field. There have been the Jefferson Lectures have been going on, for about 20 years, I think, with the NEH. They are an extraordinary pinnacle for the person who gives the lecture. But this lecture has actually been put, along with a few other poems and commentaries, in a beautiful small book that is now just out in bookstore form. You may want to read it for yourselves. In that address, he spoke of the ruined, increasingly lifeless land left by mindless agribusiness across so much of the American landscape, and of the ignored potential of the small farmer who lives and works with the life of the land. Barry calls for scaling down the totally unconscious enterprise of corporate business to community-sized enterprises, creating a habitat of mutually intelligent agriculture and life. Here's what Mr. Berry looks like on his own farm. Wendell Berry. Not Tom Berry's cousin, but his twin in terms of an evolutionary reality. The new story, as Wendell Berry explains it, calls for a quantum leap of understanding and motivation on the parts of all Americans. Because both our own culture and institutionalized Christianity have regarded the natural world as a warehouse of all the material goods that we ever needed. Instead, Berry urges us to understand and treat land, water, plants, and animals as intelligent sibling species, and make all policy, all business decisions, and planning on the basis of deeply liking and honoring the life forces of the whole enterprise. It operates now as a thin pancake of flatland facts and ledgers, profit and loss. And instead, how many of you have seen these little sponge things that our grandchildren get? You drop the flat sponge into the glass of water and it becomes a ladybug, fully n-dimensional, almost holonomic. Or perhaps in our day, with those little paper pellets, those little flat pressed pellets from Japan that we would drop into a glass of water, out would come an entrancing whole flower. The flat form is the way we're living. The flat form is the way we're doing business. The flat form is the way we're doing government. In order to get that bandwidth opened up, this is field work, we are required to see the entire enterprise differently. Berry says that it must all turn not on profit or politics or science, but on affection. That's the title of the Jefferson Lecture. It all turns on affection. Now, the synchronicity of these two segments of the news story that have come to my attention in the preparation for this morning's presentation have not been lost on me. Two very different sources point to the homely old virtue of affection as a serious operating system that actually makes us a little more intelligent and connects us to a world around us that is fully as intelligent and really much better related than we are to it. The new story, overlapping with the old story, in that perfect little lens of the Vesica Pisces, has been dealing with the new, the emergent, the information that is coming together out of the new story that wraps around all of its history in the old story, never throwing it away, never once abandoning it, because the bandwidth of intelligence is so huge as we make our way into this new consciousness that we can utilize every part of what has gone behind us. We can learn from it. We can still be nurtured by it. But it is transcended into a new set of relationships when we look at it with this new, coherent, whole body, whole brain and heart intelligence. The new understanding engages us not only with new information, but it literally changes the ground under our feet. We have to feel our way into concepts of resonance and morphogenic fields. It's one of the reasons I take pains to try to bring images to accompany the things that I'm talking to you about, because it's engaging more of your intelligence. Something is resonating within your minds between image and word constantly. Remember, out of those resonances, if they are held with enough steady intelligence, you're all still awake, so with enough steady wakefulness, something will rise out of them, just the way overtone notes arise out of Jill Peirce's sung chant. It's built into us. We have not been conscious of it. When we are conscious of it, imagine where we can begin to go with this lift. It turns the notions of the transcendent God into more of a verb than the remote, though powerful, noun that it has been in our past. We have to feel our way into the notion of operating through currents of consciousness and fields of information and arrays of heartfelt relationships. Those convergences this morning we've been talking about, there have been about five of them, offer a new platform of awareness to follow Jesus' teachings that is self-organizing across the country under the general heading of wisdom Christianity. This is the overall thrust of where this work is beginning to go within the Christian church. As we resonate with these big facts and ideas, we find that the simple act of feeling into their meaning and implication, as opposed to, say, thinking about it, critiquing it, making it into a list. No. Feeling with your brain, with your intellect. All information needs to be felt, to be fully valid, to be whole, so that you have a felt knowing about everything that the intellect puts out. When it is wrapped in the literal, functioning, magnetically resonant field of the heart, it suddenly poofs into a much larger understanding because it's taking in everything that the body is bringing in, and the body's fields are connected to all the other fields around, so that things like intuition suddenly are not woo-woo topics. Things like clairvoyance are not woo-woo. They actually happen across fields, naturally. We just don't have a catcher's mitt up to catch it with our consciousness. So we have to move and feel our way into these new concepts as opposed to critiquing them. And they will move us a little deeper into the amphibian shallows of an universe of energy and consciousness. It'll take a while to gain the gills that will allow us to move into these fields of deeper reality that Jesus taught and that the mystics wrote about. But we know now what the spiritual practices are to start that process of deep change. This is the field work to produce the field of compassion and its harvest. I actually consider world and life, word, though it is world, word and life to be a morphogenetic field. You've been at this for a long time. I dipped in and out for years before I finally had the good luck to really catch up with you guys and become a part of your group. You are a field. Excursions like this step us right into the framework of the new story. And we find that we are all field hands at work in the fields of the Lord. It's at the convergence of these two great master stories that we fully understand one of our favorite quotations. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there.